Hey everybody, this is Pierce Redman welcoming you back to episode 3 of Porkins Policy Radio, Democracy Egyptian Style. So for today's episode, I thought we could talk about the recent coup d'etat which just took place in Egypt, and perhaps break it down and put it into context, explaining what's actually going on here and who's really behind the coup, and to sort of get through some of the distortions that are being put out there in terms of who's really responsible for this coup, what's actually taking place. And the main focus is really going to be on the fact that this has been orchestrated behind the scenes by the American government, and that in reality, this isn't about the protesters, this isn't really about democracy, and this certainly isn't about the rule of law or anything like that. And in reality, this coup is being orchestrated, as I said, behind the scenes by the American government in order to put back into power the particular people whom they know best and who they like working with. And we're going to be focusing on the three main people, or groups rather, involved in this coup, and that's the Muslim Brotherhood itself, the protest movement, the so-called protest movement, and the Egyptian military. And hopefully we'll be able to break it down and show that all three of these groups are actually being controlled and manipulated by the American government itself. So I think for the first part, we should really be discussing the Muslim Brotherhood and what's really going on with them. Now, of course, if you're listening to NPR or you're reading the New York Times, you're going to get a very distorted image of who the Brotherhood really is and what their real motives are. Of course, you know, if you are listening to NPR, you'll get this sort of image of them as sort of radical group that is very autocratic and domineering, and you know, they're really more concerned with what women are wearing and teaching Sharia law, as opposed to fixing the you know, various woes that the country is facing. Now, to a degree, this is correct. I'm not going to deny that the Brotherhood isn't acting somewhat autocratically. But this, as I say, with all of these things, it kind of distorts the real image of who the Brotherhood really is and who their puppet masters truly are. So if we can just sort of get past the initial fear or misconception of the Brotherhood, and we actually look at the history of the Muslim Brotherhood, their founding, and who has been supporting them for the past several decades, we can see that in reality, the Brotherhood itself is merely a tool of Western imperialism dating back to its very inception in 1928. Right now, we can just look at a very good article on Conspiracy Archive, and in this, they chart the sort of rise of the Muslim Brotherhood and their connections with the Western intelligence apparatuses, all, you know, various ones, mainly, though, the British and the Americans. And we can go back to 1928, when the Brotherhood was first formed, and we can see that from the very beginning, they were in fact used by the British imperialists to sow dissent and destabilization within Egypt, which at the time was being colonized and ruled by the British. And in this article, they point out the fact that Freya Stark, who was ostensibly a British travel writer, but in reality was actually an covert operative of British intelligence. And during her times in Egypt, she was tasked with first making contact with the Brotherhood and essentially co-opting them and, you know, offering them money and whatnot. And the British, fearing a nationalist movement that wanted to oust the British out of Egypt and you know, basically live their own lives, have an independent foreign policy, and not be financially exploited by British interests. And this was very scary for the imperialists. So with the help of Freya Stark, they used the Brotherhood in order to act as a proxy force and basically to divide the country. You would have, you know, the two camps. You would have the nationalists who were, oh, God, you know, they're evil, and you know, you don't want to be with them. And while, as on the other hand, the sort of pseudo alternative was the Brotherhood, and they were seen as, you know, very radical. They were anti-women, anti, you know, Christian and whatnot. And this worked fairly well for the British for a while. They were able to use the Brotherhood, you know, from time to time, whenever it was politically expedient for them, to use them. As power sort of shifted within the, within Egypt, power shifting, of course, from the British to the American colonists in the 50s. And we can just take a short little thing that I'll read from you from History Commons, which, and the title of this post is 1945-1970 CIA and the Muslim Brotherhood Ally to Oppose Egyptian President Nasser. And it's pretty short, and I'll read it. And this is essentially combining a few different sources, one from a book by Bob Baer, the other one from a book by Robert Dreyfus, who did a very excellent book on the Brotherhood and on basically Western imperialism using radical Islam, which is a theme that you see time and time again amongst the Americans. But I'll read you the short clip, which I think really kind of encapsulates what's really going on between the Brotherhood and the West. In 1954, Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser, nationalist policies in Egypt can be viewed as completely unacceptable by Britain and the U.S. MI6 and CIA jointly hatch plans for his assassination. According to Miles Copeland, a CIA operative based in Egypt, the opposition to Nasser is driven by the commercial community, the oil companies and the banks. At the same time, the Muslim Brotherhood's resentment of Nasser's secular government also comes to a head. In one incident, Islamist militants attack pro-Nasser students at Cairo University. Following attempt on his own life by the Brotherhood, Nasser responds immediately by outlawing the group, which he denounces as a tool of Britain. The following year see a long and complex struggle pitting Nasser against the Muslim Brotherhood, the U.S., and Britain. The CIA funnels support to the Muslim Brotherhood because of the, quote, Brotherhood's commendable capability to overthrow Nasser. The Islamist regime in Saudi Arabia becomes an ally of the United States in the conflict with Nasser. They offer financial backing and sanctuary to Muslim Brotherhood militants during Nasser's crackdown. Nasser dies of natural causes in 1970. So as I said, this is really the reality of the Brotherhood. They have, for years, decades now, been a tool used at various times to combat whatever sort of force or movement that they deemed as dangerous to their various geopolitical and financial gains within Egypt. And this is, as I said, this is a theme that we see exploited over and over again in U.S. foreign policy. You know, we can look at the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, we can look at the MEK in Iran. There are numerous examples of using radical Islam as a proxy or a buffer to destabilize a country and basically to carry out what the imperialists can't do themselves. We can even go and look in the early 2000s when in a pretty good article by Seymour Hersh, who is debatable as to how great a journalist he really is, but he wrote a very interesting article in the New Yorker called "The Redirection," and in this he breaks down the redirection that the U.S. State Department and the White House was taking in terms of using radical Islam, using Al-Qaeda and other groups like that, to their own ends, to help them. You know, he really lays it out right then and there that the American government, then under Bush, was using the Brotherhood in Syria, of all places. And now you see that we're embroiled in a very serious conflict in Syria right now, while not totally overt, certainly a covert situation with the Americans getting involved in there. And Hersh points out the fact that the Bush administration, and this was done by Dick Cheney in particular, was meeting with the Lebanese faction that is run by Saeed Hariri, who is a politician, and he's gone on to great acclaim as a Western puppet. But Hariri believed that to destabilize Syria and perhaps overthrow the government there, that the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood would be the perfect tool to use. And I'll read you a little short quote from that article as well. Jumbalot, who is a member of Hariri's faction, then told me that he had met with Vice President Cheney in Washington last fall to discuss, among other issues, the possibility of undermining Assad. He and his colleagues advised Cheney that if the United States does try to move against Syria, members of the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood would be the ones to talk to. So again, I'm just trying to paint you a different image of the Brotherhood. They are not this anti-Western, anti-Israeli movement that is hell-bent on creating some sort of Islamic caliphate all over Egypt and the rest of the world. And in fact, they at various times have worked with Western intelligence agencies and the American government itself to, you know, bolster their own power and, you know, for financial gain as well. I mean, you have to assume that the West is paying these people fairly well to do what they want. And so this already sort of changes much of the picture that we see portrayed by corporate media, and that it really isn't the Brotherhood is not this faction that is up against the protest movement. In reality, all of these movements are being used by the Americans, and that is especially true when it comes to the actual protesters themselves. We can go back all the way to 2011 in the initial Arab Spring, and, you know, there's plenty and plenty of documentable evidence, and I'll provide all of these in the show notes, that most of these protest movements are funded almost exclusively by the State Department, by Western NGOs, who are in turn arms of the State Department, or even worse, arms of corporate America. And we can look to movement.org, which is sort of the major protest organization that was started in America and acts as they claim to help teach various protest movements in countries, all coincidentally of which the U.S. has some sort of stake in changing the regime in. But movement.org, I mean, their major donors are, you know, the likes of Pepsi and Google and Facebook and a whole list of corporate entities. So again, you know, I don't really think that Pepsi cares very much about democracy in Egypt. They really care about selling more Pepsi to people in Egypt. But this is the case, as I said, from the very beginning of the protest movement. And as I said, there's tons and tons of documentable evidence. But let's instead just focus on the current protest movement. And there's a very good article on Global Research where they document some of the various shady, nefarious characters who receive quite a large sum of money from time to time from the State Department or, you know, under the guise of the National Democratic Institute, which is a, you know, sort of pseudo-government entity which claims to promote democracy, but in reality, we know that not to be true. But we can look at some of these individuals who are really leading the protest movement right now or who are quite prominent in the protest movement. And there's one in particular who is truly a nasty character, and his name is Colonel Omar Afifi Suleiman. And he at one point served in Egypt's elite police investigation unit, which was just, you know, really notorious for human rights abuses and whatnot. And he began receiving NED funds in 2008, and he's received them now for the last 4 years. And Suleiman runs a NGO that coordinates with the protest movement in Egypt. They claim to offer legal advice. But Suleiman has had a couple of really interesting things to say on his Facebook page, sort of encouraging people to commit acts of violence. And, I mean, some of them are, you know, he had a recent one where he said, incapacitate them by smashing their knee bones first. And this was in response to Morsi supporters. He urged people to behead those who control power, water, and gas utilities. That's another little gem right there from Suleiman. And he had a further one in which he described knocking down a palm tree, putting it in the middle of the road to block a bus, and then, you know, spreading gasoline or diesel fuel all over the surrounding area. And then when the bus comes by and stops to, you know, move the palm tree, light the fire, light the diesel so that the whole bus will go ablaze and kill all of the passengers inside of it. It's these types of people who are receiving money from the U.S. government. And I, you know, I'm making this point only to sort of paint a very different picture of the protest movement itself, and that in reality, these aren't really these, you know, Jeffersonian Democrats in Egypt fighting for their right to freedom of speech and whatnot. Now, obviously, there are many people in Egypt who, in fact, are doing this, but unfortunately, as with most radical groups, be it the, you know, Black Panthers or anything, Students for Democratic Society, anything that you can imagine throughout history, they are always co-opted by the state itself. And this is done, of course, to limit their true influence. And overall, this is what is really going on in Egypt. This is an attempt to form a counter-revolution, not a real revolution. And we can look at some other Morsi supporters who receive a ton of money. And we can look at Ezra Abdel Fattah, who is an Egyptian woman, and she has been a long-time guarantee of the National Endowment for Democracy grants, amongst other things. The National Democratic Institute is another one. And she, you know, has urged activists to lay siege to mosques, to attack religious figures, imams, and so forth. And she, you know, even after inciting some of this violence, you know, several people died in clashes. And she continues to receive, you know, $75,000 grants at a time. And it's interesting to note, for anyone out there who thinks, oh, this is just a conspiracy theory or whatnot, but the National Endowment for Democracy has actually deleted all of their records of grants given to Egyptian groups from 2011 and 2012 on their own website. So indeed, they are nervous about people really looking into what's going on there. So right now, where we are is we've got the Muslim Brotherhood on one side, which is a, you know, Western puppet and has been for years, funded by the CIA and all these other groups. And then on the other side, we've got the protest movement, which, as I said, is also funded by various Western NGOs and the State Department itself. And what's really going on here is an attempt to control the situation. Now, Egypt is the most strategically important country in the Middle East, both regionally and culturally, socially, and financially, especially with all of the trade, especially in oil, that goes through the Suez Canal. Something around 10% of the world's oil passes through the Suez Canal. So for America, this is a huge and very strategically important nation. And you have to assume that they would never in a million years actually let real change take place within Egypt, especially with Egypt's next door neighbor being Israel, of course, which when it comes to the Middle East, everything is viewed through the lens of how will this affect Israel. So what's really going on here is an attempt to circumvent a real and true revolution from actually taking place. And we can see that, many of the protest movements, you know, real grievances towards the Brotherhood were in fact that it was too pro-West, that it was too pro-American, that they, you know, basically did whatever Obama and his cronies told them to do. And we can see that through his acceptance of IMF conditions for bailout money, which is basically amounts to, you know, liberalizing the economy and opening it up to Western globalists to come and, you know, pillage whatever resources and businesses and industries exist within Egypt. We can see Morsi's sort of about face in terms of Gaza and helping the Palestinians. Hamas is, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood's Palestinian branch. There was some thought that when Morsi came into power, and he certainly campaigned on a message of helping the Gazans, helping to ease the illegal blockade within Gaza, upheld by the Israelis and the Americans, of course. And we really didn't see this happen at all. He, you know, sort of opened up the Rafah border crossing here and there, but it was never anything really serious. And, in fact, he basically held up most of the security demands that Israel had in terms of its security with Egypt. And then of course we can just see, I mean, the mere fact that, you know, a lot of people do know that the Brotherhood is in fact a tool of the West. As we can see, Nasser, as far back as in the 1950s, understood that they were a tool. So for the average person, we see that. Now, of course, the really insidious aspect of this is that the West then funds the protest movement. So that the protest movement will never really get off its feet. They'll never really have a real voice anywhere. This is all the more clear when we look into the Egyptian military itself and how they're nothing more than a puppet of the Pentagon. And this is pretty documentable and pretty obvious even to the average person. We can just look at the $1.5 billion in aid money that the United States gives to Egypt. And of course, this aid money is in the form of weapons, missiles, airplanes, guns, ammunition. And whatever is not given in straight-out weapons is, of course, siphoned off by various military elites, and that disappears into bank accounts in Switzerland and other places such as that. So we've got the military here, and they've been nervous now for a little while. They were scared initially when the protest movement started because they feared that they would lose their grip on the economy within Egypt. And, you know, little known fact, but the military actually controls virtually every aspect of the economy within Egypt. And this goes for businesses, this goes for any sort of industry within Egypt, steel, things like that. That is controlled by the military. The same is said for tourism, which is a huge driver, economic driver in Egypt, or really anything. And the Egyptian military feared this very much so. When Morsi did come into power, he did fear the military to a degree. When this second protest movement started, the military certainly viewed this with, apprehension. They were afraid that the protest movement had become weary of Morsi, and they weren't really willing to put up with him anymore. And at the same time, certainly there are elements within the protest movement that didn't necessarily want, Mubarak to come back to power. But of course, this is the case. And furthermore, the American government, which is really the true ruler of Egypt, feared an actual protest movement starting. And as much as they have been able to co-opt and, infiltrate these various protest movements, there certainly was a real fear that the protesters would be, they were sick of Morsi, they could be sick of the military itself. And this, of course, would be horrible for the American government. I think that this, of course, is my own speculation, but I think there would have been a fear that the protest movement would have somehow been able to topple Morsi, and then they would be left in a situation where they really couldn't control it, and that in reality, a real, actual democratic revolution could take place. So, of course, this runs counter to all of the supposed interests that the United States has in Egypt and in dominating the Middle East. So what does America do? Well, they tell the Egyptians to overthrow the government. this is evidenced by the fact that Chuck Hagel, who is the U.S. Defense Secretary, was in constant contact with General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who is the defense minister and who was the person who was in charge of leading this coup. And this was on, you know, military.com, which is basically a mouthpiece of the Pentagon. And they don't even really hide it that al-Sisi was in constant contact with Hagel. And, I mean, you can only imagine what those phone calls were like. So we've got the U.S. military establishment talking with Egyptian military. We've got this general feeling that we cannot let a true revolution happen. So they, you know, institute this sort of fake revolution. And certainly the Egyptian military has been able to portray themselves in the media as some sort of benevolent force, which is really concerned with the average Egyptian citizen, and that they, you know, Morsi was evil and he was a fundamentalist. And this is the general picture that we're painted when it comes to what actually took place. You know, and we can see, the White House Press Secretary Jay Carney giving these really just asinine explanations as to what really happened, claiming, though, this isn't a coup at all, and there's really, you know, this is totally fine, nothing is wrong here, and we're not going to stop any of the aid. You know, we can't, that's too dangerous. And maybe I'll play you actually this little clip of Jay Carney discussing why you know, Obama is not going to stop funding the Egyptian military, which of course just overthrew the only democratically elected president in Egypt's history. And really just listen to this, because the sort of verbal acrobatics that Carney goes through here are quite astounding.
Jay?
Yes.
Just to be clear, is the administration actively considering cutting off aid to Egypt?
What I would say, John, is that we are monitoring the situation in Egypt. We are taking the time necessary to make the determination about what happened and what to label it, if you will. And we will work with Congress on that and on the issue of further assistance. I would point out simply that our relationship with Egypt is not limited to or defined solely by the assistance that we provide to Egypt. It is broader and deeper than that. And it is bound up in America's support for the aspirations of the Egyptian people for democracy, for a better economic and political future, and we support that. We support that process. So our decisions with regards to the events that have happened recently in Egypt will be, and how we label them and analyze them, will be made with our policy objectives in mind, in accordance with the law, and in accordance with and in consultation with Congress.
But I'm just asking a very specific question. Mm-hmm. I think you answered it in there, but let me just be direct. $1.5 billion in aid to Egypt, is one of the things under active consideration cutting off that aid?
I think it would not be in the best interest of the United States to immediately change our assistance programs to Egypt. We think, not just I, but we think that it would not be in the best interest of the United States to do that. We are reviewing our obligations under the law, and we will be consulting with Congress about the way forward with regards to specifically the assistance package that we provide.
In other words, no immediate cutoff of aid.
We think that would not be in our best interest.
So there you go. It's in our best interest. Our, of course, being the American government, the state, and not really in the Egyptian people's interests. And just, you know, really trying to hammer this point in, that this really isn't about democracy, and that this is all being controlled by people behind the scenes, mainly the American militarists and imperialists. And that, you know, they're really, at every step, the Americans have been trying to control and manipulate what's actually going on. And we can see that when they installed the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a puppet, as we've stated before. And the same is true with the protest movement, and, you know, the same is true with the military. So at every step, America has someone that they can rely on. And I just want to go back to General al-Sisi, because I think it's important in understanding how this is a counter-revolution if we just explore who General al-Sisi is for a moment. And there's a really good article on stratrisks.com, which revealed, at least to me, I wasn't aware of this, but that al-Sisi is in fact a graduate of U.S. Army War College. For anyone who doesn't know, U.S. Army War College is a very famous college in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and it was established, maybe 100 years ago or so by, I think it was Theodore Roosevelt. And basically what the Army War College does is it trains the, next generation of military people within America. And, their main student body is composed of Army, but also Navy, Marines, Air Force, CIA, which is interesting. And of course, every year around 77 foreign military people. And these are, of course, are, composed of our major allies. So we've got Saudis, we've got Jordanians, all sorts of different people. Definitely the Egyptians. And al-Sisi went to this Army War College. And basically, though, what Army War College really does is it recruits these people, all of these foreign military officials that come and train there. They basically become assets of the U.S. military elite. And it's interesting, again, to note the eerily similar circumstances between the coup that happened in Mali last year and this coup that happened here. Colonel Sonogo in Mali, who is a low-level colonel, who was the one who implemented the coup, was also trained in America at a Marine training base, I think in Fort Bragg. And again, the similarities between al-Sisi being trained in America, Sonogo being trained in America, and if we really want to hammer this point in that much of these things are really being orchestrated by America and the West, we can look again with Mali and Egypt. In Mali, parliamentary elections were to be held within a few months, and Sonogo overthrew the government, this guy who was trained at an elite military training base in America. And the same is true in Egypt. In November, parliamentary elections were to be held, and in theory, of course, with parliamentary elections, the Egyptian people could have voted out Morsi. They could have done all of this constitutionally, which is the same case in Mali. Amadou Toumani Touré, who was the president, was viewed as being sort of weak and soft and on terrorism and the Tuaregs. But of course, they could have waited just a few months and they could have elected whomever they wanted to. But instead, of course, most likely at the behest of the Americans, the military overthrew the government. And now Mali is, of course, controlled exclusively by the military. And Mali is another country which has very close ties to the American military establishment. But let's move back on to Egypt and sort of just sum up what we have here. We have what I've said before is a counter-revolution. The goals and aspirations of the Arab Spring in 2011 have been completely dashed. Instead of actually having a real people's government come to power, what we had was the Muslim Brotherhood being installed, and then they sort of fell out of favor, and that's okay for the Americans. They use many of these Muslim groups and then just throw them away. So they disappear, and then we've got this controlled protest movement that raises their voice or whatever, and what are we stuck with now? Exactly where we started all the way back in 2011. We are back to military rule in the country. We can see all of these appointed people now, be it the president or the vice president, these are all cronies. We've got the vice president, of course, in Egypt now, the interim vice president, unelected, installed by the military, is Mohamed al-Baradei, who, for, again, anyone who doesn't know, is the very definition of a Western puppet. Al-Baradei is, of course, controlled by the International Crisis Group, which is a U.S. think tank, which receives massive amounts of money from various global corporations and you know, has on the board of directors there such luminaries as billionaire George Soros and war criminals Zbigniew Brzezinski, Richard Armitage. So you can see that al-Baradei's loyalties do not rest with the Egyptian people or with democracy, but instead they rest with the various global elites who wish to rule the world and control everyone. And it's not just al-Baradei. We can look at, I mean, any of these people. The now interim president is a man named Adli Mansour, who is a judge who it's a little difficult to get much information on him, but he is in fact a Mubarak loyalist. He was appointed by Mubarak. He vociferously pleaded to have Mubarak loyalists on presidential tickets, on parliamentary tickets. So he was trying to do all he could to help install Mubarak loyalists after 2011. We've got the now new head of intelligence in Egypt is a very shady general who, among other things, was in charge of investigating the Brotherhood and persecuting them. And he's a man by the name of Mohammed Farid. He's a general, and he was extremely close with Ahmed Shafiq Zaki, who is a former Egyptian Air Force commander. He was a member of the Supreme Military Council and was even the prime minister of the interim government in 2011. So we can see that, you know, they're stacking up the interim government, and who knows how long that's going to last. It could be indefinitely. But they're stacking that up. They are basically replacing everyone that they possibly could with people that are subservient to the Egyptian military and, more importantly, subservient to the West and to their political and economic agenda. And just to kind of leave you with one last thing, and that sort of is, what is this all about? What is this really for? This is, of course, a much bigger issue, and hopefully pretty soon we'll be doing a whole podcast just on the recent destabilizations that have been going on throughout, in particular throughout in the Middle East, and that is, of course, in Egypt, in Libya, of course, in Syria now, in Mali as well. And basically, all of these countries are being destabilized by the West, by America in particular, in order to just simply sow chaos and to make sure that they never really progress past, you know, the level of being completely subservient and reliant upon the West and upon the various global elites that really do control most of our lives, unfortunately. And, you know, we can see right now in Egypt that there are these pitched battles between Brotherhood supporters and between the Mubarak loyalists as well, and that this is really what the end goal, in fact, is. We can see the 50 people who were murdered in the streets the other day by soldiers, and we can see that there's already question about who really killed these people. You know, there were snipers on the roof, and it almost, to a degree, it doesn't really matter, because this is what they want. They just want you to be suspicious and nervous, and they want to make you fear everybody, and this is the end goal. But with that, I think we'll leave it here. I think we've got enough. I would urge everyone, as I always do, to read the show notes, because there is a lot that I wasn't really able to get to in everything. And apologies for not having something up sooner, but I will be having a couple more podcasts coming up in the very near future, hopefully by the end of this week, if not the beginning of next week. So I'll see you then, and Ramadan Mubarak to all of my listeners who are celebrating Ramadan.